Next case is United Access Technologies v. AT&T et al. 2017-2614-15-16-2018-10-30-31-32. Mr. Garza.
Mr. Garza, before you get started, if I could just ask a procedural question. There's a lot of focus on the specification and the claims, and I didn't see anywhere that we were told what specific claims are being asserted. I know 61 of the 546 and 1 of the, 446 and 1 of the 585, but are there any others?
It's an excellent question I should know the answer to. I know those are the three independent claims that are asserted here. Yeah. I believe there are a couple of dependent claims.
Okay, but we should focus, I gather, principally on those three claims. Is that fair to say?
Correct, okay. Especially here where the dependent claims that are in the patent don't have positional limitations in them.
Good. All right, thank you.
Right. May it please the court. There are three problems with the district court's construction of signal interface. First, the term does not impose implicit positional limitations. Second, the specification does not require that every signal interface be found at the boundary of both the public network and the local networks. Third, the specification does not mention telephone company ownership and does not define the position of signal interface on that basis.
Well, as I understand it from your brief, there are two embodiments here that are alleged to infringe. One is the remote embodiment, and the other one is, I don't know what you call it, the exchange embodiment?
Central office embodiment, yes.
But under if the district court's original claim construction was correct, you argue that you could still recover under the remote embodiment, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
But if the district court's original claim construction was correct, you can't recover under the exchange embodiment, right?
So the central office embodiment?
The central office embodiment.
Yes, and that's because if the court imputes an implicit positional limitation that requires a signal interface to be at the end of a public trunk line that comes out of the central office, it would exclude embodiments where the signal interface is before the public.
Yeah, because there are two separate positional limitations or interpretations that could be given here. One would be to say that it has to be north of the trunk line, and the other one is that it has to be below the twisted pairs, right?
And respectfully, we have a third option, which is you look to the claims instead of imposing implicit positional limitations.
I understand that.
Of course. To uphold the district court's non-infringement judgment, you have to find that all three of these problems were not actually problems, so the district court got everything correct. So we'll start with each point in turn. First, all of the asserted claims include explicit positional limitations for signal interface. With the 585, the signal interface has to be between the telephone exchange and residences, not the public network and the local networks, not at the boundary of anything, and there's nothing about ownership. By looking to the term signal interface to impose additional limitations, you're effectively rewriting the claims. Second, not all signal interfaces disclosed in the specification are at the boundary of both the public network and the local networks. Let's start with the local networks. The specification includes examples, many examples, where the signal interface is not at that boundary. So if you look at figures 1A, 1B, and 16, each of those figures identify and delimit what the local networks are. They're marked with circles or rectangles, depending on the
figure. But when you say at, are you incorporating at or downstream of? Or are you just focusing on at?
So when we're talking about the local networks, the downstream portion isn't in there. If they say at the boundary of the public network and the local networks, as the district court found, that is what they found, it's inconsistent with those. If we're looking at the downstream embodiments, defendants solve some of their problems of reading out disclosed embodiments by changing their construction to at the boundary to at and downstream. But what they lose is the support of the specification. If you look carefully at the specification sites they use to justify their construction, the invention statements, they all discuss the signal interface being at the end of the public trunk line, not at and downstream. So they have two choices here. Either they have the specification and it supports the limitation that it's at the boundary, and they've got problems because it conflicts with preferred embodiments. Or they take the position that it's at and downstream. That solves some of their preferred embodiment problems, not all of them. But they've lost their support from the specification. They can't have it both ways. They've got to choose whether it's at the boundary or at and downstream. So, again, it's also true that the specification includes examples where the signal interface is not at the public network boundary. The easiest way to see that one is figure 16. Figure 16 includes a signal interface, but the signal interface does not interconnect whatsoever with the public switch telephone network. There's no trunk line. There's no boundary between the public network because the public network doesn't connect with it.
You say that figure 16 includes a signal interface, but why isn't that just an interface that isn't necessarily a signal interface, as that term is used in the particular claims that assert a signal interface, which is not all the claims?
Yes.
Because the signal interface is tied to telephony, and this device here has no external telephony connection in 16.
It is still a signal interface because it still carries two different types of signals on the same wire. And still,
we don't have a definition anywhere in the specification of what a signal interface is. It pops up in the claims, oddly enough.
But in each of the embodiments that discuss the signal interface, figure 1A, figure 1B, figure 16, they all label it the exact same way.
But figure 16 doesn't, the discussion of figure 16 doesn't refer to signal interface. That's my problem is, why isn't it possible to read figure 16 as simply an interface, not a signal interface, unlike figures 1A and 1B?
Well, one of skill in the art looking at the transceiver switch 400, which is the embodiment of the signal interface in figures 1A and 1B,
right,
would see the same transceiver switch 400, certainly, in figure 16. It's all labeled the same way. And when you look at the specification prose about figure 16, it is clear figure 16 is an extension of the same transceiver switch that we saw with telephony. The big difference being, because you're not using telephone signals, you're using different signals. So if you're using the term signal interface to make this distinction between figure 1A, 1B, and 16, it's hard when we're still talking about signals. Had they used the term telephony interface or something to that effect, I think the argument would have more force. But I think the word signal doesn't do the job. There are still signals in figure 16 that they're trying to separate and use on the same wire with the transceiver switch 400. Mm-hmm. So finally, the district court erred in using telephone company ownership as the way of measuring the extent of the public networks and the local networks. The specification does not define public or local anywhere related to ownership. Instead, the specification explicitly defines local network as internal to residences or offices or rooms and buildings. And we know that local is not coextensive with ownership because, again, of figure 16. Figure 16 is a completely privately owned embodiment. There is still a transceiver switch 400. And the local networks are identified and delimited. It's only a part of figure 16. So ownership is simply not the metric, not a metric supported by the specification in determining where a public network ends or a local network ends.
How is figure 1A consistent with your argument that the central office embodiment is infringing?
So figure 1A, our use of figure 1A is to show that various portions of the district court's claim construction is incorrect. We are not using figure 1A to address our primary argument, which there are no implicit positional
limitations. Okay, but putting that to one side, mm-hmm. if there are implicit positional limitations here, isn't figure 1A inconsistent with your theory that the central office embodiment is infringing?
Yes. So if the signal interface has to be at the end of a public trunk line, the central office embodiment does not infringe.
So to perhaps oversimplify this,
sure.
Your position, initially you say none of the figures really limit you. Figure 1A, figure 1B for sure. But beyond that, you say accept Judge Stein's construction and her conclusion that summary judgment would not be appropriate with respect to the remote terminal embodiments, but would with respect to the central office terminal.
Correct.
Okay.
That's our position. So those are the major points I was hoping to cover.
And the principal difference, if I could just to tie it down, the sure. principal difference that I understand you to be pointing to with between Judge Thang's construction and Judge Stark's pops up principally in Judge Stark's infringement analysis, where he adds the private network is local versus public is company owned. And that includes, in his view, the first wires to the remote terminal as being company owned and therefore not within the scope of the infringement of the figure 1A.
Yes.
Is that a fair characterization of your the way you parse those two claim constructions?
Yes. And just to be clear, what Judge Stark did is say, we will look for the point where the telephone company ownership ends, and that's the NID. That is supported by the record. We're not fighting that. He said, the NID, therefore, is where the signal interface has to be. The signal face is not there. They do not infringe. That analysis is wrong for the three reasons we pointed to earlier. One, ownership is not the right metric. Two, it doesn't have to be at the boundary of the local and public networks. And third, there are no implicit limitations.
And anywhere. Your argument, I take it, from figure 1A would be that the NID is at the local network interface 404.
Correct. There's also a disclosure of the NID at column 7 near the top that explicitly calls out the network interface device as being between the signal interface and the local networks. I know I'm in my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve that.
We will save it for you. Mr. Hawes.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Hawes, and I represent the defendant appellees. Let's start with figure 16. There were a lot of eggs put in the figure 16 basket. Counsel relied on it both for his argument that ownership is not relevant.
Let me ask about 1A here first. How okay. is 1A consistent with your argument that the remote embodiment does not infringe? Because it seems to me that it pretty clearly shows 400, the interface, being upstream of the extended pairs. And how is it that their theory about the remote embodiment is incorrect?
Your Honor, figure 1A shows what the inventor decided was a possible network. He said, you could build it this way. You could take your private wires and arrange them as shown here with going down the what are called extended pairs. That's not how it happens in the real world. Someone could have built the network this
way. I'm not sure that I'm understanding. Mm-hmm. Under your theory, the transceiver switch, which is the interface, number 400, would have to be on the other side of the extended pairs under the claim, right?
No, Your Honor.
No?
No. Your Honor, the extended pairs here are the private network. So the
How do we switch... know that? How do we know that's the private network in the sense that it is the wires are not owned by the telephone company?
If you'll turn to column 8, we can see that the inventor specifically says that with respect to his invention, and I'm looking here, Your Honor, at this is on the appendix at page 288, and it's column 8 of the patent. And it's specifically talking about this transceiver switch at line 10. At the end of line 10, it says, this device replaces the existing interface between the public telephone network and the telephone lines that lead to the individual residences.
Right.
So it is saying that that switch is at the edge of the public telephone network. And that's exactly why Judge Stark said, this is a coined term. Let's look to the specification to see what it says about it.
Well, but the public telephone network is defined in the patent as the public telephone trunk line.
Well,
and not that doesn't seem to me necessarily to include the extended wires. the extended pairs, right?
Your Honor,
you're not calling the extended pairs part of the trunk line, are you, or are you?
Extended pairs can't. The extended pairs is just a description of a wire.
A wire?
That could be on one side of the handoff. It could be on the other side.
Yeah, but you have to have an extended pair to get from the trunk line to the residence, right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. There are actually embodiments discussed in the uncontested declarations about the accused systems.
Okay, typically you have extended pairs that go from the trunk line to the residence, right?
Your Honor, that is hard to say. Really, right now we're going to different formats where there's fiber optics, which is discussed in the declaration. So no, not necessarily. At this time, there were extended pairs. So going back in history.
Are you saying that in 1A that these extended pairs are owned by the residence owner rather than the telephone company?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what I'm saying.
What evidence do you have of that? In the specification that was intended to be designated as private lines, including the 1,000-foot lines all the way to the telephone pole.
The fact that the patentee specifically says, look, what I'm doing is I'm putting this switch at the edge, at the handoff of the public telephone network. And if you look in the figure,
the
that means
lines.
That... No, not IE. The trunk lines are part of the public telephone network.
No, it says IE. They're in the patent. Public telephone network is defined as the public trunk lines.
Your Honor, that is part of it. But no, the patent also talks about the central office. If you look at, for example, figure 1A, the local exchange is also referred into the patent as part of the public telephone network. So it certainly is not just the trunk.
Local exchange is way down. That's at the end. That's at 475, which is way beyond the twisted pairs, right?
It is, but
that
it's
is part of the trunk line, sure.
Well, actually, the patent talks differently about the trunk line versus the local exchange. Those are different parts of the public telephone network.
The trunk line leads to the local exchange at the other end. I mean, there's no question that local exchange doesn't have anything to do with what the proper characterization of the extended wires is.
In the
right?
system proposed by the inventor, yes, the trunk line leads to the local exchange and the switch. And that's the system proposed by the inventor. What I'm trying to make sure is clear is the accused systems don't line up to that. So that's an important distinction. The counsel in the reply brief gave you these two figures and said, oh, look at them, they're the same. Except the elements are all different. For example, they say themselves, you heard him just say, well, there's a NID in column 7. But in column 7, what he ignores, and this is looking, if you remember in their brief, they specifically make this analogy. And this is on page 7 of their brief, Your Honor. I think this is an important point because there's confusion here, and I want to clear it up.
The blue brief?
This is the blue brief, Your Honor, on page 7.
Okay.
So on page 7, I'm looking at the second bullet point. You see that list of bullet points there? They say that located upstream from local networks, local interface devices, NIDs, and extended pair wiring. Okay, NID is a term used in the accused networks. If you actually look at that reference, that column 9, at 9 to 16, what you'll see is that they refer to, and this is at lines 12 to 13, they refer to local network interface device. They then use the term local network interface 90 times in this specification, never using device again. The reason the language is different, the reason there's an LNI here and there's a NID in our systems is that this doesn't do what the NID does in the accused systems. They are falsely saying these are the same things. They're not. The local network interface was a way they used inside the private network to move signals around and control, filter signals, and move them from one space to another. The NID is a handoff. And if any of you have ever had repair work done, you'll know it's really important because if it's on their wires, the company pays for it. If it's on your wires, you have to pay for it. That's what a NID is.
The NID doesn't do any filtering or converting?
In the declarations, it does talk about the fact that it can, but it doesn't do the functions that the signal interface does, which is why they can't accuse the NID. And they've never accused the NID of being a signal interface. So it's important to realize a second point here, and I do want to get to that.
So if you look at 1A, and the extended pairs are considered to be part of the public network, contrary to your argument, then the remote embodiment does infringe, right?
Your Honor, the figure 1A is a different system than the accused system. So I can't really answer that. It's not,
you can't answer,
it's not the same system. Well, you're asking me, this is figure 1A, which was proposed by the inventor. It doesn't line up with the accused system.
Well, let's put the question slightly differently.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you take Judge Dyke's hypothesis, then at least Judge Stark's ground for entering summary judgment of non-infringement would have to fail, correct? Because he predicated his judgment on the ownership issue.
So I think it would go to his claim construction, because you're saying, look, figure 1A has public network below the switch. You proposed that. If that were true, that would be a fact that would weigh against his construction, right? Because then it wouldn't make as much sense to say that signal interface...
It would defeat his construction, wouldn't it? The construction that he gave in the infringement summary judgment decision.
Okay, so Judge Stark's construction did not change. He applied the same construction.
Okay, but let's say hypothetically we think it did change, and that the first construction said that it had to be where the trunk line connected to the extended pairs, right?
Can I point the court to his first construction? Because I have it in the record.
Okay.
That construction is in the record, and it is specifically in the record at page 67. And this is, you'll see it in the table. It's the last one of the table. And it's interposed at the opposite end, i.e. the local side. So he's talking about a side, not the boundary as we've been hearing, but the side.
Right.
And he says, of the public trunk line, but he defines that. He says, i.e. the telephone lines comprising the public telephone network. Then in the uncontradicted declarations, which I would point the court to, those are in the second and third volumes. There are three declarations, Your Honor. The first one for each of the companies, but the language is fairly similar. These are uncontradicted.
This is Mahoney, Beanek, and Golub?
That's right.
All right.
I'll use Golub because it's in volume two. But all of these talk about the fact that the public network downstream of the RT embodiment, and this is in paragraph 12 on page 3128, the public network downstream of the RT embodiment is identical to that of the central office embodiment. So this is that distinction that you were talking about, Judge Dyke. Twisted pairs are bundled to run to multiple serving terminals. So we're not talking about single extended pairs that are downstream of the remote terminal. We're talking about a bundle, which is the public trunk line. That's exactly, and this is part of what is owned by the public telephone network. So he was looking at uncontradicted declarations saying what they've accused as being a signal interface has downstream bundled twisted pair. Not single twisted pair going to separate residences, bundled twisted pair. That's in paragraph 12. There was no evidence entered by the plaintiff contrary to that. And the same language is in the declarations for the other two accused systems.
So where is it in your view that the bundle, the individual twisted pairs coming out of the various, let's say, the local interfaces of a multiple residence system, where is it that that turns into the trunk line? For example, just because we have the figure here in figure 1A.
All right. So figure 1A shows individual extended pairs that it labels 405.
Right.
So figure 1A, as you know, shows that it at the switch you have a trunk line, a bundle going in, and you have extended pairs coming out that are going to each local network interface. And those,
when you say a bundle coming in, are you talking about the bundle that consists of 405A through E?
No, I'm talking.
No, you're talking about the
twisted pairs 746.
Well, it's actually 476. It was another mistake.
Yes, I know, and I just said, but I corrected the mistake. But if you contrast that with the language in the declaration, you'll see that is not the system with the remote terminal embodiment. Instead, that bundled twisted pairs is below the remote terminal. That's why it can't be a signal interface, because it doesn't meet that. And I do want to point out one thing, Your Honor.
That's an issue that wasn't reached by Judge Stark, right?
It was. Judge Stark, on pages 52 and 53 of the record, said those declarations are uncontroverted and said that's my basis for summary judgment, and said that the networks are described as having these bundled wires, this public telephone network, downstream of what's accused of the signal interface. That's uncontroverted, and that's the basis for summary judgment. It's in his summary judgment order at pages 52 and, or sorry, record pages 52 and 53. I'm going to go ahead and use my rebuttal time because it seems the panel's more interested in the non-infringement issue. But if you have any questions on indefiniteness, I'd be happy to answer them. But I really want to talk about figure 16 because counsel put so much on the figure 16 and every claim. And by the way, Your Honor, Judge Tyson, you asked which claims. It's only claim 61 of the 596. It's claims 1 to 5 of the 446. And it is claims 1, 2, 4, 8, and 9 of the 585.
1, 2, 4, 8.
And 9. 1, 2, 4, 8, and 9.
All right, good. Thanks.
Every one of those claims, Your Honor, if you look at the independent claims, every one of them is talking about a system with a telephone network, which means that the signal interface language used in there, no person of ordinary skill in the art would look at figure 16. As you pointed out, that figure has no telephone network. So when you're looking at this coined term, and that's a finding by Judge Stark. He found there's no plain and ordinary meaning for signal interface. So he was looking at this coined term in the context of the claims in which it was used. Figure 16 has no impact. Figure 16 cannot be an embodiment of these claims because it doesn't have a telephone network, which is required by every one of these claims. So because signal interface was a coined term, because Judge Stark gave the proper reading to it. And I would also note that we haven't been told what the construction is that was below. There's been no support from UAT's construction below, which was a locational construction. It talked about the convergence point. No support for that in the briefing, no support for that today in the argument. I would ask this court
that this is the argument that they really haven't pressed the Judge Stein construction. They've attacked Judge Stark's, and they've argued in favor of a no locational interpretation claim-based, but they haven't taken the middle position.
Not only did they not take it, they criticized it.
Yeah, that's right, because they don't want that, because they want more. But it does seem to me that it's a fair reading of their brief that they, as a fallback position, they'll take Judge Stein's position.
That may be a fair reading of their brief, but under interactive video, if they didn't preserve that as a construction below, they're not allowed to argue for that construction here.
Well, of course, Judge Stark stated that he was adopting Judge Stang's construction in his claim construction order. I believe you agree with
that. I mean,
that.
We can look at his wording. His claim his construction wording, is yes, not I, identical I, to hers.
Well, when he finally ends up with whatever his final claim construction was, which really doesn't pop up in clearly until the summary judgment order. But then there's no doubt that he is adopting a different claim construction, which leads him to a different conclusion.
But the wording in his claim construction order is different, Your Honor. It is a different claim construction than it was from the get-go. His words are different. And it's those words that in the declaration are compared against the accused systems, which is this court's approach to assessing infringement.
Well, before you sit down,
yes, Your Honor.
In terms of the indefiniteness, then why shouldn't one read these claims as saying that high frequency simply means above the voice band?
First of all, Your Honor, Judge Thine relied, and this court affirmed, a J-mole of anticipation relying on high frequency being more than that. So in the Earthlink case, the prior art was actually distinguished because it didn't have a higher frequency, not just above the voice band, but higher than that. The second thing I'd point you to, Your Honor.
Did you make that argument in the brief?
Did we, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Not specifically, no, so I'll point you to the Camerata display.
If you didn't have it in the brief. Why shouldn't high frequency mean simply above the voice band?
If you'll look at appendix page 2430, Your Honor. That is their, that is, this is the applicant's description of high frequency.
You mean their claim construction?
No, this is their statement to the patent office that high frequency had an independent importance.
2430.
That's right, Your Honor.
This is the Camerata disclaimer.
It is.
Between 250 and 500, or what was Camerata? It was 300.
Camerata went up to a half a megahertz.
So 500 kilo.
500 kilo. Yeah, that's correct, John. So they specifically say, nor any type of circuitry for preventing transmission of signals in the high frequency band. That high frequency band had independent importance for them. Camerata, no question, Camerata was blocking well above the voice band. So they had to say high frequency was above that. They couldn't just say high frequency is at the edge of the voice band. So that's completely inconsistent with their current position that high frequency is anything above the voice band, even if that didn't render that language mere surplusage in the claim.
Thank you, Mr. Hawes.
Welcome, Your Honor.
Mr. Gaza, take 5 minutes if you need it.
Thank you. I have 4 points I'd like to cover.
Before we get into the other issues, could you just address that last question about why shouldn't high frequency mean above the voice band?
So that is our fallback position, so we're okay with that position. Okay. But I would like to take a stab at defending Judge Stark's construction. I think the reason
I find Judge Stark's construction so convoluted and complicated and relying on interpretation of various parts of the specification, it seems to me it's hard to follow.
Well, I think part of it comes from the construction of the term voice band frequencies. If that term were, as we argued at district court, that it is the frequencies, whatever they might be, carrying the voice band information, then the construction of high frequency that you're proffering today is the natural extension. Judge Stark did find, as defendants argued, that voice band frequencies are between 0 and 4 kilohertz. He put limits on those. And that's why it's not a stretch for one of skill in the art then, if one of skill in the art made that conclusion, to find a hard limit for the high frequency terms. And that's how he reached the construction he did.
Well, he tries to say it has to be above the voice band because it's necessary to be above the voice band to prevent interference, right?
Correct, correct.
And you know, how much above is not very clear to me from the specification. And so I think it's a construction that leads to indefiniteness problems.
Well, in the very least, if the court is inclined to reach claim construction on the high frequency term, I suggest the court does send it back down and ask the court to reconsider the high frequency term and the voice band frequency term. I do think they go together. And it's hard to have one without the other. The points I wanted to raise, though, first, you know, Judge Stark did not make a finding based on whether twisted pairs were bundled.
Did you want to say anything about the Camerata disclaimer?
I think the portion in our brief addresses our position on it, and it's what Judge Stark found as well.
Do you have anything more than that to say about it?
No, but
I didn't actually find that all that persuasive.
Well, you've
neither A nor B usually means neither one.
Usually, but we know that's not the case here because of Reichert. If you look at Reichert figure 1A, and that's at the...
Are you talking about Reichert or Camerata?
Reichert. So the Camerata disclaimer is the Camerata and Reichert disclaimer.
Well, I understand, but Camerata specifically blocks 300 to 500 kilohertz.
Yes, but what the disclaimer says is neither Camerata nor Reichert disclose, and then it follows, correct? So if it were either or, like you're suggesting, it wouldn't work with Reichert. If you look at figure 1 of Reichert, Reichert says, here is a low-pass filter. It blocks 0 to 4 kilohertz. So this sentence makes no sense if you require Reichert to not have a low-pass filter, which is the interpretation the defendants want.
I've probably taken up more of your time than I should.
All right. So first, Judge Stark never considered the bundled twisted pair point that defendants pressed here on appeal. That was not in the appellate briefing. It wasn't in the district court briefing. It's not anything the district court has considered. Second, I know there's been a lot of discussion about figure 16. We don't need that discussion to win. We don't need that figure to win on claim construction. Figure 1B is an example where the signal interface is not at the handoff of the public network. It is within wholly private networks that private companies are responsible for. There's embodiments where the signal interface is in closets of apartment buildings. Again, not owned by the telephone company. So figure 16 is important to us and helpful, but it's not necessary. Now I'm going to try to bolster figure 16. If you'll look at the specification at column 69, column 69 lines 49 to 51 state that figure 16 is just like what we've had before with a couple of changes. And the changes are we're taking out the telephones and we're taking out, you know, the various frequency requirements we use with telephony. There's no signal here that this is completely different of something of such a strange ilk that the signal interface should be considered differently between the two embodiments. Any other?
I do have a question. Sure. So how are we to tell when the extended wires become the trunk line? Your figure 1A has a picture of the extended wires going into the signal interface. And you characterize that as the extended wires going into the signal interface and not the trunk line, which you say is on the other side of the... but suppose that you move the signal interface up in the upstream direction by 50 feet. So you've got... the extended wires have now been bundled together and they're going into the signal interface. Does that not infringe because they've been bundled together because there's a tie around them?
All right, so this is the bundled analysis that wasn't in the district court. But no, it doesn't change the analysis at all.
So how about if it's not 50 feet, it's a mile?
Doesn't change the analysis. So what you should be thinking here is the public trunk line connects two major components owned by the telephone company. It connects the signal interface where all the wires are connecting to a signal interface. And all of the wires are connecting to
it. My question is predicated on the notion that this signal interface now, in my hypothetical, is in the middle of the trunk line.
No, it's still not in the middle of the trunk line, even if you move it up the trunk line. So the wires that have moved...
I mean, when you say even if you move it up the trunk line, it's not on the trunk line? I just put it on the trunk line.
Correct. So
why isn't that outside of your patent?
Okay, so what happens to the lines coming out of the signal interface? Are they still run to individual residences? That is why it's no longer a trunk line. Instead of connecting two items, it's connecting an item and a bunch of residences. Because it's branching off at the end, that's why it's not a trunk line. It has nothing to do with whether you move the signal interface up 50 feet or not. The fact is the line is branching to multiple residences. It's not a trunk line.
And what happens to those lines after... I don't know a lot, as it may become evident to you. I don't know a lot about how the telephone system works, but once you get past the signal interface and you are on what is indisputably the trunk line, what is the way that that trunk line functions that is profoundly different from the way the wires that go, the extended wires function? And now don't go into the optical, but just stick with the old-fashioned wired system for the trunk line.
Yeah, old-fashioned wired system. Yeah, they're no different. Just copper twisted wires that would go up.
Right, but, and they continue from the residence all the way to the central office.
Yes, but because it's a trunk line, you're not stuck with that. You get to change to an optical line. You get to mess with things.
But how do I know, at least in the old style, which I assume still exists in mm-hmm. many places, how do I know that I'm now on a trunk line and I'm not on the extended wires?
Because you're connecting to items owned by the telephone company and not going to individual residences. It is that branching that kills the trunk line.
I'm really not following this because you're saying, stay with me here. Mm. There's a wire which goes from my house up to a point at which it joins wires from a lot of other houses in the neighborhood. And they're all bound together like that. And they're all put in a conduit. And then they go up a little ways, and then there's a signal interface. And then out the other end of the signal interface comes the same kind of conduit with the same wires. Are you telling me that on the south side, on the downstream side of that signal interface, it was extended wires, but on the upstream side, it's the trunk line?
Correct. So
why?
I think
how can that be? It's the
same thing. I got an answer
thing.
For you. Got an answer for you. I think you're looking at it structurally and I'm looking at it functionally. You're thinking if there are wires bundled together, it's a trunk line. I disagree. I think the wires upstream of the signal face are a trunk line because they functionally act that way. They connect two parts of the telephone network. At, you know, they're using all these resonances together. They're treating them together. Once they exit the signal interface, even if they're still bundled together for 50 feet outside of the signal interface, they're still running to the resonances. They're still not functionally a trunk line anymore.
So why is the, suppose we have 10 wires inside this set of wires that's going into the signal interface, and there are 10 wires that come out of the signal interface, okay? And one of those wires goes to my house. One of the wires that started in my house goes through the signal interface and it comes out of the signal interface, and that's identifiable as my house wire.
Yes.
And that's suddenly different functionally in a way that makes that a trunk line when it's down, when it's upstream of the signal interface?
Yes.
And why?
And it's because the telephone company can treat those 10 wires together as a unit now. They're processing together. They can change it with fiber optics. They can do a lot of things they can't do when they are connecting them straight to the residences. When they're connecting them straight to the residences, they're stuck with the signals that the residences expect.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.